Well, the first thing you could tell me was the date, where and when you were born.
Born in London, 1932.
Mm-hmm. And who were your parents?
Who were they?
Yes.
Father's name was David Lederman, and mother's name was Sylvia Doris Lederman. Mm.
What did your father do for a living?
He was on the stock exchange mm-hmm. with a firm called Carr Ware, who were known as shunters. Mm. They arbitraged between country houses, country stock exchanges, mm. and London, mm. which I didn't know very much about, mm. obviously.
Yes. And your mother simply, she stayed at home and kept
yes.
the house?
Yes. Mm. I think my father was known to be a fairly hefty gambler, and mm. like all these things, when he was up, he was up, and when he was down, he was mm. down, and mm. had two or three of those situations. Mm. Gambled a fair bit on the stock exchange, I mm. think. And that's basically how I got to the stock exchange, my mother.
Good. It's basically how you came to
the stock exchange. Well, I can recollect my younger brother joined the stock exchange. And this is the time, of course, of national service. My mm. older brother was doing national service, did his, came out, went to the stock exchange after a while. I did my national service, came out, and went to the firm that both my other brothers had been to, which was mm. Smith Brothers then, mm-hmm. which was 1953 mm. when I joined mm. Smith Brothers.
Did your younger brother stay with Smith Brothers?
No. He did his national service, and then when he finished his national service, there wasn't room for him back in the firm. I had been prior to that with a couple of other firms, but that was purely as a messenger boy. Mm. One was with a very small firm of Gilt-edged jobbers, and literally one went round to the Bank of England, collected transfers, and had to deliver them round the city by a certain time because of all the payments and what have you. Mm. So at least I found my way around the city fairly quickly. But then, as I say, I came out of national service and went straight to Smith Brothers in mm. March 53.
Mm. Let's go back a bit. Where did you go to school?
Whittingham College, mm. which was a private school, which was based in Brighton. But when I went, it was during the war, and the school was evacuated to South Wales. So I spent 90% of my time in South Wales.
Mm. And after school?
After school, virtually, I did these couple of jobs in the city mm. when I must have been 16, 17, and then into the army for mm. 2 years national service.
How did you get these first jobs? Were they through contacts?
Must have been somewhere along the line. I think it must have been my mother phoning somebody up in the city. Mm. But as I say, they were absolutely runner boy jobs and tea boy.
Were they jobbing firms? Or
one was a jobbing firm. The first one was a jobbing firm, which in actual fact closed down. And then the second one was an extremely small firm of brokers, extremely small firm of them, who literally had private clients. They didn't have any institutional business at all, or as it was then. This was just private client mm. stuff.
Do you have any particular memories of those firms?
Only minor incidental things in it. The second firm, I mean, they didn't even use carbon paper to copy letters. They had a press, mm-hmm. And you had to screw this press round to get another copy. And if it was overwatered slightly, the thing, then you ruined the letter, which I certainly did on a number of occasions. This was the broking firm, yes. But I don't think I was at an age then when I was in any position to really know what was going on as far as the stock exchange was concerned at all.
Mm. And then you went straight on to national service?
National service, and came out in March 53, and I think within a week of coming out, I started at Smith Brothers. Mm.
And your contact there was your brother, was it?
Yes. I think my mother had got one of the brothers in, and then the sequence followed. And I joined there.
Mm. What attracted you to the stock exchange?
I think probably the family had been there before. Mm. And I suppose, quite truthfully, I wasn't qualified to go into the professions or anything like that. Mm. And it seemed to have provided a passable life for us as a family. And I must admit, I did enjoy it. I did enjoy it.
Had your father retired by then?
He died during the war. Mm-hmm. Not actively. He, I think he had a stroke or some such thing. Died in 1943-44, I think, something like that. Certainly whilst I was at school.
Mm. And what was the first job you you had when you arrived in Smith's?
A clerk in the office, doing things such as jobber's ledgers, writing up the bargains in the afternoon. The dealers used to come back from the stock exchange, take out the profit and loss, and then you would get their joint books and you had to write out all the bargains so that they could be checked the next day, you know, with the broking houses that the firm had dealt with. Then it started, after a while, got slightly more sophisticated. You were looked at as a potential to go into the actual stock exchange. In other words, the ladder was showing that you were going to be a dealer at some stage, and the first stage along that was going from the office to becoming a blue button, or you became a red button in actual fact, which was a checking clerk. Mm. You had to go and check the bargains from the previous day early in the morning with all the other things. If you did reasonably well at that, you became a blue button, which was when you were definitely marked out. That's when you actually first went into the stock exchange itself.
Was it all promotion by merit?
Strictly speaking, yes, but I suspect that there might have been a helpful hand from friends of the family or something like that. Mm. But the firm didn't suffer fools gladly, so if you were no good, I mean, they would tell you so. On the basis that it was better for you to know early on, because it would be unfair for both sides, really. Because we certainly asked some of the partners' sons later on to leave. I can think of one who just, he wasn't a jobber. And it could be costly. And it was, again, it was possible that if you didn't make it as a jobber, you might well turn out to be a good stockbroker. Mm-hmm. The mentality is totally different of the two. So, again, you could help people by asking them to switch sides. It's interesting, the dress then. You had to wear a stiff white collar and dark suit and black shoes. Discipline was quite strong, although the hours, of course, were totally different to the hours now. Mm. And to my mind, one of the beauties, came with hindsight, was this was a small firm who one could see was starting to grow.
In what ways could you see that?
The attitude of the partners, they were basically all self-made people. I don't think any of them had qualifications of any sort. Three or four of them had been in the war together, I think, and they were ambitious, wanted to succeed. And I suppose if you had successful people, it was easy to double from one to two, and two to four, and four to eight. It's a bit tricky when you're going from 156 to, or 256 or whatever, to 500. Mm-hmm. And there was this attitude in the firm, I think, and it was exciting.
Could you say something about the partners as individuals, fairly early on in your career with them?
Well, the senior part, who of course one didn't know desperately well, being a youngster, the man I worked under basically was a man named Sidney Davis. I started off in the South African mining market, and to my mind he was extremely shrewd, honest man. You had to tune into the thinking of your boss, or try to, and he was absolutely clear-cut with his thoughts on which way the market was going to go. He was extremely friendly with another one of the senior partners, a man named Henry Marks, who was totally opposite in his approach, I think, to the business. He was a flair man. Logic didn't come into it at all. He was an absolute flair man. He would walk in one day, this market's going to do so and so and so and so, move one way or the other. Mm-hmm. And his flair was right 7 times out of 10 or 8 times out of 10, but two totally opposing attitudes. Mm-hmm. And I think, from my personal opinion, that was marvellous for me, because I caught both sides of it. And they were my tutors, as such. The senior partner at the time was a man named Wilfred Ranson, who was extremely clever man, extremely astute, respected by the whole of the Stock Exchange, but I didn't come under his wing at all, but he was the, well, the headpiece of the firm as such. And the other senior man around about that time was a chap named Sidney King. You know, I think probably my brother's told you more about because he worked with him directly. So again, I didn't have a lot to do with him.
Did you build up a fairly close working relationship with the jobbers with whom you were directly working?
With the other jobbers?
Yes. Well, with the ones, the particular partners whose markets
you were. You mean in one's own firm?
Yes. So Sidney Davis. And
yes. I mean, yes. There was an age gap, obviously. I don't know. I suppose in my case, 15 to 20 years with someone like Sidney Davis. But well, I think you've got to build up a relationship. If you're working day to day, he'd certainly turn around and kick me up the arse fairly strongly if I'm doing things wrongly. But basically, I certainly appreciate him, and I think he appreciated me. Otherwise, as I said before, he would just turn around and say, you're no bloody good, or something like that, and either move me to another pitch, which happened at times, if people were incompatible. Well, it happens in all walks of life, but a respect for each other. But if two people just don't gel, then they could be moved to another market or such. But I had a very good relationship with both Sidney Davis and Henry Marks. Henry Marks, I think, was a more friendly man out there, in that he would certainly, I suppose, three times a year or something like that, one would go around to dinner at his place. Mm-hmm. He lived in town, which was helped a lot. Sidney Davis lived in Hove and was slightly more remote. I think a shy man underneath it all. But I enjoyed the relationship with them both.
Where were you living at this time?
In London. In London. Getting the tube into work. I think, if I remember right, we had to be in the market by 9:30. I seem to remember coming out of Bank Station about 9:25, sprinting up to the office to collect the jobbing books and sprinting down to the market, and I suppose like all youngsters, getting there with about 2 seconds to spare or something like that. And
did you ever pick up any stories from the partners about the firm before you'd actually joined it? Or
not a lot. I didn't. One of the partners then who was on the way out was a man named Maurice Smith, who was the connection with my mother. And I think in poor terms he said, you know, you're joining a good firm and that sort of thing. But no, I think you've found out for yourself what the firm was like. It was basically a Jewish firm. There was a certain amount of anti-Semitism around then. But I think if you played the game, and played it by the Stock Exchange rules, and there was no problems at all.
Mm. When you say Jewish firm, do you mean that the brokers who were coming up to deal with you were from Jewish firms, or
no,
the personnel in the office itself were
the majority of the partners were Jewish, so it was recognised as a Jewish firm as such, and it might have been that certain brokers in those days would not deal with you because it was a Jewish firm. And vice versa, it might have been some dealt with you because you were a Jewish firm, you know, but there was in those days, I'd say 10% of people might have cast a doubt over the firm's financial position or what have you.
About how much time was it between starting with the firm and being sent to the Stock Exchange as a checking clerk?
In my case, I was probably lucky. Or quicker than most. I started in March 53, and I think towards the end of 54, I went down the market. And that was probably because my brother, we both made members at the same time, and it might well have been, had he not been there, I might have had to wait for it. Mm. So I think I was pushed through slightly quicker because there was a training period, or should have been a training period. You had to do a certain time as a blue one, which I think was 2 years. My memory serves me correctly. As I say, I was pushed through rather quickly.
Mm. Now, could you talk a little bit about the firm at the time you became a blue button? What markets was the firm dealing in?
I say, I was in the South African gold mining market, which had been its original strength. Mm-hmm. It dealt in the equity market, in store shares and general equity shares, your ICIs and court holds. Dealt in oil shares in a very pathetic way. This is where the old partner dealt, I think he was just a one-man fellow there. And that was basically, if I remember rightly, really what all it dealt in. And as I say, it was a firm that was starting to grow and then expanded rapidly over the years.
What? How did it compare in terms of size with other jobbing firms about this time?
Well, at that time you had a hell of a lot of jobbing firms, or from one-man firms to fairly sizable firms. It was in the small to medium range. I mean, there were a lot of firms who were a lot bigger. As I say, there were also one-man firms. Capital-wise, it was very small. I can't remember the figures, but in relation to today, there was a sort of, if not a permanent capital crisis, you were looking over your shoulder that you weren't over-trading, which I think's been apparent in the place for years and years anyhow. Mm. But it's partnership of 4 to 6 people, what have you. It was in the lowish range, but on a progressive move, I think.
Do you have any particular impressions or memories of the house about this time when you started? Did you find it a bit intimidating going into the stock exchange as a blue button fairly early on?
Yes, very much so. It was a new world. And I think the first day I stood myself next to my partner, and on each area there were stock exchange waiters who stood on a high dais thing, and they had tubes where they could blow down and hear people. And if someone outside the stock exchange was calling my partner or something, this waiter would stand up and call the blue button to say you were wanted outside the stock exchange. And I couldn't understand a word this chap said to start with. They always just put their hand below their mouth to make the voice carry. Mm. And of course, we've got several hundred people in the place, you've got to hear. And to my mind, he was a chap who looked like Winston Churchill. I can see the chap now with his top hat on. He stood up and went, "Bop!" Oh, I stared at him, and he did this "bop" 8, 9, 10 times. I stared at him, and he started calling me. He said, "I'm calling you." I said, "What do you mean I'm calling you?" And after a month or two, I realised "bop" came out of Smith. You know, for a month or so. So you stood there shaking, so you were watching the waiter in case you were going to be called, also trying to follow what your partner was doing. As against which, there were some extremely friendly people in the place who realised he was a youngster starting out. A lot of them were very, very helpful. Not necessarily in business ways, just come up and say good morning to you, and were extremely friendly. There were a few nasties as well. You always got your mixture of people, but it was frightening. But then gradually, as one got involved with it, then it became an extremely nice place, extremely nice place.
Well, you've already mentioned the dress standards. Was it very formal in other senses? I mean, were there all sorts of unwritten rules of behaviour and how you addressed people and so on?
There were. Trying to recollect. You were never allowed to ask if a broker came up onto your pitch to deal and you weren't quite sure which firm he was with. You were not allowed to ask him. And the theory was that as he left the pitch and went walking around the stock exchange, the blue button, such as myself, had to follow him round. And when he went to speak to a chap a few yards away, he went up to that fellow and said, "Excuse me, sir, could you tell me who that gentleman was with?" And he would. I managed to get hold of a chap once who came on the pitch, dealt with us, and we weren't sure who he was with, so I had to go and follow him. And he walked round the stock exchange, just staring at balls, didn't speak to a soul, then walked out of the place and started to walk down to the Bank tube station. And by which time I thought, well, I better abandon this one. Yes, it seems ridiculous in this day and age that you couldn't ask, but there was that sort of code. as against which there was the playful time when the men let off steam. I mean, there was always throwing of paper balls and that sort of thing. And particularly guys wearing top hats, you know, pick up, throw a top paper ball at his top hat. Or the joke was putting torn up newspaper, a little bit of newspaper in a chap's umbrella. You know, put it down his umbrella, and then as he started to walk out, up went the umbrella. So of course the shower of paper came down. It sounds childish, but all these little gestures. You weren't allowed to run, really. You know, if you had to do something very quickly, you had to walk very fast. You know, if you knocked into an old member, he'd haul you back very, and certainly if you land on a chap's shoes.
Did a lot of these sort of practices continue for a long time, or were they gradually disappearing? For example, people running around wearing top hats.
Yes, they do. Yes, it changed with the ages. I mean, from top hats, it went to bowler hats, and then to no hats, really. The dress got relaxed. I can't remember how long stiff collars were in, but then I suppose someone came in a soft shirt or soft white shirt, and then years later someone came in with a soft coloured shirt or what have you. Yes, it all changed, but I think the attitude was, well, let's be seen to be at least 20 years behind the times, that type of thing.
So did members of the house actually enjoy having some of their eccentric practices? So kind of made them a little bit distinct from...
Yes, I think it was the way of letting off steam in its way. I'm sure everyone was under pressure then because it was a competitive world, perhaps not as competitive as now, but in that day and age it was. And that was the way of letting off steam, or no doubt maybe across the road to the pubs and the bars and what have you. And it did create an atmosphere of the place. And I would have to say that I think the stock exchange of those days had more recognition than it does now. I certainly remember many, many years ago going into a shop in Burlington Arcade at Christmas time to get a present, and I bumped into a chap from the stock exchange there, and whatever I was buying, the chap behind the counter said, "I got my chequebook out," or something. I said, "Is that all right?" And the other chap said, "He is a member of the stock exchange," and there was no quid. "Oh, member of the stock exchange. Oh, perfectly all right." Mm. You know, I suspect one couldn't do that now.
Could you describe a typical day when you started, more or less when you started as a Blue Button? You'd from actually leaving the house to get to the office and then going onto the floor and assisting the partner during trading right through to the end.
I'll try. as I said before, it was going by tube to work, getting out at the bank station, running up to the office, and you had to get the jobbing books of the area that one was working in. So I was working in South African mines, which was split in two halves, and where I was working, there were three or four jobbing books, taken down to the market, and then the market opened at 9:30. And
how big were these books, actually, physically?
The books were probably, to make a man on interview, I was going to say the size of that.
Lengthwise,
yes. Yeah. And almost half in size. In other words, you just wanted two or three columns to write the number of shares you were dealing in, the name of the broker you had dealt with, and the price of the share. And you had another column to keep a constant running position of what your position was in those shares. And that was one of the jobs that the Blue Button had to do, because your senior dealer was dealing and you would listen in and book the bargains at times. And have to say, he would turn around and say, "What's my position in Lorraine Gold? You're a bull of 8,462, and what have you." So you had to be quite good or quite quick with figures, because if it was busy, and at times it was busy, not only were you dealing in Lorraine Gold, he was dealing in 8, 9, 10 stocks and booking bargains. And then, of course, as I was saying before, he had to know, in broad terms, what his capital position was. And if he was a bull of all these stocks, quite clearly his financial situation or his capital situation might be tight. Mm. and from the risk angle as well, because you want to keep a balanced book. So basically, you were in there at 9:30, and then the dealings were starting. You also, with some of your best brokers, some of the professional brokers, experts in South African shares, you had to do a list for them, keep them up to date with their prices. Because in those days, they were speaking to South Africa, and there was a 2-hour gap sort of thing. But the arbitrage, you could actually buy stock in South Africa, come in and sell it in London, and there'd be a turn in it, or vice versa. So these chaps had to have the absolute up-to-date prices all the time, and that was one of the jobs. After a while, you were told to go and do so-and-so's list. So you had to know your prices of 20, 30 stocks. And then, of course, your boss might suddenly shout for you, because another thing you had to do was run limits, which was when brokers would ask you a price of a share, and if a client had said, I'm a seller of these shares at £1.20, for example, in modern money, and the price of the shares was only £1 at the time, you would have a limit page, and you would put a note in, sell at £1.20, and the name of the broker. And if the share suddenly moved, or the market opened up high, your boss would turn out, quick, go and bid that broker for that stock. And you were competing, because he would have left that limit with four or five other jobbers. And these brokers, boxes or individuals, could be anywhere around the stock exchange. So you had to learn also where all the brokers' boxes were.
Mm. It must have been sink or swim fairly early on.
It was. It's amusing its way, because you went tearing off at times. And of course, you then had to find the individual in that firm. And he might be having a coffee across the road, anything. But it worked. It worked in its way.
Would you ever have to pursue them outside of the house? Or would you
No, you would leave a message with somebody in that firm, trying to state very clearly it's Mr. Snooks's business. And of course, you got known yourself after a while by the brokers, particularly the professionals, because you were involved with the professionals all the time. A partner might take a message for you, or the individual concerned might have left a note with all his partners and said, look, I've got business on in X, Y and Z shares. If anything happens, please deal for me.
So, and this would be going on throughout the day?
Yes. Broad terms, I say you were trying to keep your partner in touch with his positions or the firm's positions. You were doing your limits, and in those days we had boards on the wall with all the stocks up, and your job was to alter the prices of those, you know, using blue if they were going up and red if they were going down. And it all took time, because as you were doing that, so you were keeping an ear out for what your partner was doing, if he was dealing, because you wanted to know what was going on, because quite clearly if he was doing a big deal, there was going to be a change in price or what have you. And one of these professionals can't say to you, what's the price of Welcome Gold? And, you know, you suddenly shoot out a slightly old price, and your partner might have heard, no, they're not that at all, the price has changed. That's the sort of stuff. So it was exciting.
Was there a lot of background noise?
Yes, yes. I said, particularly if the markets were busy, because in those days, certainly in the mining market, there was a lot of open bidding. You know, the jobbers would shout out there what they were trying to do. They would bid for stock. And if a price was changing, he would make the change by, if the comparison now was, the share was £1, the best bid was £1, and he decided, no, he was going to bid more, he'd suddenly shout out 102 by whatever the stock was, and vice versa if he was selling. So certainly at times you could get a hell of a lot of noise. Hell of a lot of noise, but it created the atmosphere of the place, because if there was no shouting, then it was a quiet day and there wasn't much business going on, and the days could be very long if there was nothing happening.
Mm-hmm. And presumably then you were competing directly with other jobbers who could hear what you were calling, and they would be altering their prices if they...
Yeah, but hear what you were calling if you were bidding openly. Yes, you didn't bid openly all the time, of course. At times you were doing your secret deals. If you bid openly, perhaps stimulate a market, perhaps to con other jobbers. You might have bought a lump of stock at £1, and you were actually trying to sell it, and you thought the best way is, I'll try and call these up. You know, and everyone thinks this is a better market suddenly. So you went in and bid 102. Now, one or two of the jobbers might think, I think he's conning me here, and they might sell your stock, in which case your bluff might well have been called. It was part of the game, part of the game.
So when you say call a price, well, you wouldn't indicate whether you were it was an offer or a bid price. Or you say, would you say I bid?
Yes, if you were doing it out loud, yes, you had to bid or offer one, or you could make a two-way price, bid and offer price out loud if you wanted to. No, it was quite clear what you were doing. It was in fractions in those times, 9/16 by Free State Gadol, or 5/8 by Free State Gadol. It was exciting, particularly at times where there might have been, there were very few in the South African market, a takeover type situation going on, where certainly one of our competitors had some business at one stage, I do remember, and round about lunchtime he went into the market and started bidding for this stock, and I think the things were standing 11 shillings there, 11 shillings by Dominion Reef. Everyone looked around, then 2 seconds later, 11 and threepence by Dominion Reef. Then 11 and six by Dominion Reef, 11 and nine by Dominion Reef, 12 shillings by Dominion Reef. You know, so you weren't quite sure what was going on. This transpired afterwards, this chap had a very big order, very big order.